Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, look at the history of the U.S. nation-building efforts through police training. While this has been a cornerstone of the U.S. strategy in rebuilding Iraq and Afghanistan in the 21st century, you might be surprised that the U.S. has a long history going back to the beginning of the 20th century in building national police forces, and that history is as mixed as our current efforts today. My guest today is Jeremy Kuzmaroff, the J.P. Walker Assistant Professor of History at the University of Tulsa. He formerly taught at Bucknell University. He is the author of two books, the previous book, The Myth of the Addicted Army, Vietnam and the Modern War on Drugs, and his latest book looks at nation building through police training, Modernizing Repression, Police Training and Nation Building in the American Century, and examines the legacies of U.S. nation building efforts in places like the Philippines, Haiti, the Dominican Republic, Nicaragua, Japan, and Vietnam, and how more times than not, the security apparatuses associated with these nation-building efforts repress democracies and civil liberties more than they enhance them. Jeremy Kuzmaroff joins us to talk about his book, Modernizing Repression, here today on Studio Tulsa. Jeremy Kuzmaroff, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Your new book looks at nation state building and how the U.S. is, well, its history really of building up police forces and sort of domestic security structures in various countries. And we think of that today in terms of Afghanistan and Iraq, and we think of this as a pretty new thing for the United States to be involved in. Your book says we've been doing it for well over 100 years.
Yeah, that's correct. I think it, a formative intervention was in the Philippines when the U.S. colonized the Philippines, beginning with its invasion right at the early 20th century.
Spanish-American War. Right.
Exactly. And right after, I mean, the war ultimately generated a lot of public opposition with the revelations of atrocities by U.S. soldiers, and it was becoming very costly. And there was, it was questionable whether the U.S. should maintain a military force there. So the U.S. political leadership at that time made the decision to pull back the U.S. soldiers, but to try and build up a Philippine constabulary that could advance U.S. interests in a more cost-effective way. And that was seen as a very effective policy, although the constabulary did engage in some violent and repressive behavior. But it served the U.S. ends. And gradually, there was a process of Filipinization where U.S. soldiers, who initially were in a leadership role in that organization, gradually ceded to Filipino leaders. And the political structure evolved in Philippines in a way that was initially beneficial to U.S. interests.
And that was a model that we've followed through most of the century.
Absolutely, yeah. The book goes into many Cold War interventions where that was a primary strategy, in part designed to prevent full-scale military intervention, which is costly and which can generate a lot of public opposition.
And that's in addition to the nation-building exercises in World War II involving Japan and Germany.
Mm-hmm. Well, Japan is a crucial chapter that I go into in my book because that was very formative in the development of the police training operations during the Cold War. Because a lot of during the Cold War, the operations were run out of USAID under this Office of Public Safety. And many of the key personnel gained important experience in Japan working under General MacArthur to mold the police force in Japan to basically bolster the U.S. occupation and ensure stability during that period.
But we don't think of the Japan occupation in the same way we would think about the Philippines or many of the nations of Central America where we've intervened over the years and done the same thing. What was different about Japan?
Well, Japan initially is quite interesting. Actually, I argue it was a major turning point because initially a lot of the personnel involved and the leadership of the U.S. was promoting New Deal-type reforms within Japan, and they were pushing for measures to uphold civil liberties among the Japanese police force to purge fascist elements. And initially, I think there was considerable improvement among the Japanese police force because of some of the reforms. Even in the prison system, they were managing the prison system as part of the nation building, and they pushed for more lenient measures, liberalized measures. But there was a shift that I trace with the so-called reverse course and the hardening of the Cold War mindset and the growing fears that the Japanese Communist Party was becoming a formidable political force within Japan at that time, and with it, the so-called loss of China, the fact that China had experienced a revolution and the U.S. feared its strategic position in Southeast Asia at that time, the U.S. shifted course, and the police programs, they began to de-emphasize civil liberties. They promoted a more centralized police force. And so, and they actually rehabilitated some members of the Toko, the Japanese secret police. And initially, some of the surveillance operations were targeted towards war criminals, but they began to spy on the Communist Party, and that began to lead to some abuse of, you know, civil liberties and human rights. So it wasn't as extensive in Japan as many later operations like Vietnam. So on the whole, yeah, Japan was much more successful in terms of U.S. policy and didn't, you know, generate any major human rights violations. Although with a de-emphasis on civil liberties, you do see a return to some of the more oppressive tactics of the Japanese secret police in the later phase of the U.S. occupation. So that, I argue, kind of portended ill for some of these later interventions like Vietnam, where those programs were linked to major human rights violations and that were ultimately publicly exposed with the tiger cages and abuses that were going on in the South Vietnamese prisons.
Now, one of the questions a lot of people have had as we've gone into these nation-building exercises here in the 21st century is how much did we take from these experiences, like how much from the Philippines, how much from, you know, various Latin American countries where we've intervened, from Haiti and the Dominican to Nicaragua and a lot of the countries of Central America. How much did we look at these models when we were designing these models for Iraq and Afghanistan, or not much?
I think there is a pretty strong degree of continuity that's exemplified in a few of the personnel. There are a couple of personnel who served in Vietnam with those operations or served in Latin America and have been senior advisors or actually been in Iraq. So there is some continuity of personnel, and I think the approach is quite similar, and I think there have been studies undertaken by the military and other State Department to study previous operations and to base it on a similar model. So I think there is a strong degree of continuity, even if the public has not really been so aware, because a lot of these programs have been carried out in secret, so the public is not necessarily conscious of that. But I think there is a degree of institutional continuity at play, and I think the military has studied previous operations and looked to certain operations like Philippines at the turn of the 20th century as some kind of model.
Well, let's start there before we talk about the conditions today. The Philippines was the first big nation-building effort by the United States. At the end of the Spanish-American War, the Philippines were ceded to the United States. At first, we were welcomed as liberators in the Philippines, but when it became apparent that we weren't going to give the Philippines to the Filipinos, all of a sudden there became an insurgency, a very nationalistic insurgency. Mm-hmm. For the first few years, we had a strong military presence, and we were fighting battles in the Philippines well after the Spanish-American War, weren't we?
Well, there's an excellent book by Alfred W. McCoy, and he's an expert in the Philippines and has lived in Philippines for many years, and he goes into the history. Actually, he provides, and I base part of my chapter on his study, but he points to differences in terms of Iraq and Philippines, because he argues that in the Philippines, the U.S. and the constabulary was actually very effective in ultimately co-opting the nationalist movement, and they were able to bring a lot of the nationalist leaders from Aguinaldo to smaller scale leaders into the, sometimes it was through blackmail, they had through surveillance certain information on them that might be compromising, and these leaders made the decision to come over to the occupation side. Some of it may have been opportunism on their part. He actually compares that to Iraq, where and many consider that a major mistake of the U.S. occupation was the initial de-bathification policy and the unwillingness to accept any Ba'athist members who provided basically a right basis for the insurgency, because they were discarded. Anybody associated with the Ba'ath Party was discarded, and when they were developing the military and police forces, they tried to build it essentially from scratch and recruiting outside the Ba'ath Party, and that created an insurgency right away in Iraq. Whereas the Philippines, yeah, gradually they were able to co-opt the nationalist movement, though there were also, as I discuss in some depth in the book, there were fragmented rebellions throughout the country in Philippines that continued, yeah, even into the 1920s, even into the 1930s. And the most notable was the Moro or Muslim enclave within the Philippines.
Which is still in rebellion today.
Exactly. So,
yeah. But obviously, we learned a lot of lessons in the Philippines, and it was really turning over the police into Filipino hands and let them handle a lot of this, wasn't it?
Yeah, there was a process of Filipinization, and by the mid-teens, Rafael Crame was the first Filipino constabulary chief, and he was a protege of this American officer named Harry Bandholtz. So that process of Filipinization, yeah.
And that became the model for many countries. And what ends up happening, and especially in the Cold War dynamic, is that those constabularies become very much internal security apparatus, so that the ruling party always remains the ruling party.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was the word used, internal security. And yeah, in a lot of the countries, it was understood that there was no real military threat to those countries. The threat was from within, you know, rebel movements, leftist groups, socialist groups. And so that's often what did lead to considerable repression, because they were targeted towards their own population, and they engaged in, you know, surveillance and sometimes extra-legal type operation raids. And
now, how much was the United States involved in those extra-legal shenanigans, whether it be illegal eavesdropping or perhaps more intrusive sort of denial of civil liberties?
That's a very good question. My sense, it was, see, the CIA at times used the USAID as a cover for some of its agents. So my sense is some of the police advisors were just doing routine police, technical work, training the police in certain technical skills, trying to upgrade their equipment, giving weapons training, and that kind of thing. The CIA, from my senses, was involved in the more kind of hardline political policing operations. And so some of the more extra-legal tactics would tend to be more on the CIA side and kind of secretly perhaps supported, depending on the country. In some cases, there was protests. Like some of the documents I reviewed, for instance, recall like in Dominican Republic, one of the police advisors was irate that the police had kind of gone off the heels and were engaged in, you know, extensive corruption and actual death squad operations. And he was just writing to his superiors that this is a terrible situation. So there's some of that. Some of the advisors were, when abuses started to take root, some of them expressed dissent and were very uncomfortable, especially because, you know, this was a civilian organization, and a lot of them came from civilian police forces in the U.S. where they weren't. Although there were red squads in the U.S., the kinds of abuses that were taking root in some of those countries were much worse than anything that was happening in the U.S. But some of the CIA personnel were involved, you know, directly in political surveillance and eavesdropping and activities that, yeah, in retrospect, were extra-legal. So I think there are divisions within the U.S. camp about that.
Yeah. And, of course, you write about in Central America, in Haiti, really some repressive organizations had their roots with the U.S. nation-building efforts.
Yeah, I think part of the problem was the militarization. Once civil wars developed in particular countries, or if the police were really designed to stabilize an occupation, they could justify extra-legal tactics that, you know, this we're fighting a war and we're an important dimension of the war. We need to gather intelligence. You know, we need informants in these leftist organizations. So they can justify that kind of activity in a military context. And it's cases, yeah, like Haiti, Nicaragua, or Vietnam, where the most extensive abuses took root, and it was in the context of wars. And they were heavily, again, yeah, a point I stress is that it was the militarization. They were really militarizing police forces in those contexts, and that's what led to a lot of the abuses.
My guest today is Jeremy Kuzmarov. He's the J.P. Walker Assistant Professor of History at the University of Tulsa, and his new book is titled Modernizing Repression, Police Training and Nation Building in the American Century. And, you know, I was just thinking in the recent years, of course, we've had Afghanistan, Iraq, but I assume the U.S. had some major presence in the former Yugoslavia, whether it be Kosovo or some other efforts. I mean, this has been a part of our role as the world superpower since the end of the 1940s. Are we developing new models for nation building over that last 50, 60 years?
Well, I think there is a lot of consistency, and yeah, it's tied to a certain political agenda of, you know, advancing U.S. supremacy, and that's often at the heart of the problem, because if the U.S. is trying to prop up regimes to advance its own interests that aren't necessarily those of the interests of the population, that can lead to problems and repressive-type activity. So, but the USAID was abolished. This Office of Public Safety was abolished because of the scandals associated with Vietnam and the links that were uncovered with the training of police forces who engaged in torture in South America. That organization was abolished, but gradually police training programs revived under in the late 80s, the State Department developed this organization called ICITAP. And some of them, like you mentioned Kosovo, it's shrouded in controversy and kind of secrecy. There's not that information. We know that that was an important dimension of the kind of post-conflict nation building and efforts to stabilize the country after the NATO invasion, but there's not all that much information that has been released. But one difference I could point to in the current programs, and a very controversial element, has been the use of these private companies. A lot of it now has been subcontracted to companies like DynCorp out of Virginia, and the old Blackwater may have done some of these operations, though there's other companies, and that's been very controversial. And some, because I interviewed some of the OPS veterans, and some of them felt that that's been, including some who are in Afghanistan and Iraq, and they're very weary about these private companies because they feel there's much less accountability than when they were operating.
So less accountability and less standard. I mean, you know, perhaps less standards of training.
Yeah, and also I think what I go into in the book is that a lot of the people who served in the Cold War era had distinguished backgrounds in U.S. policing institutions where they had pioneered important reforms in domestic police institutions, or they had risen to important positions and had good general records. That's why they were often selected for the program, because they had cleaned up, you know, say, a local police force. One of the operatives I focus on, named Jeter Williamson, is still known as the best police chief in North Carolina, Greensboro, because he had cleaned up corruption within the force. And so, you know, they sent him overseas to try and promote reforms in police institutions that the U.S. was training and using. Yeah, there was a larger agenda at play. But yeah, if you compare that to the present, see, these companies may not have the same recruiting standards. And they pay a much higher wage now, so there's a lot of people just joining for opportunistic reasons, and they're not necessarily selecting police who have, you know, good records here in the U.S. And there's cases of police, even some of the individuals managing the program in Iraq had very checkered backgrounds in the U.S., including some links to, you know, they were facing lawsuits for human rights abuses in prisons, for instance, here in the United States. And there was very little of that in the Cold War. Like, even Japan, I go into in terms of the prison officials who were running the Japanese prisons were noted reformers who had written books, important books in the field of criminology.
Were the people that were sent to Japan.
Yeah, they had very good records in terms of domestic police police or prison institutions.
It almost sounds like, you know, you would think that the Cold War ideology would trump everything. The fact that you had to have stable regimes because you felt like you were in this life and death struggle with communist ideology. But it sounds like they took it more seriously.
Well, in that time, yeah, maybe people are a bit more cynical nowadays. I mean, there was maybe more of a cause to believe in. So that is perhaps one difference.
Now, how overriding was the Cold War ideology in nation building during that period? You know, as I recall it, you know, it was like we're almost keeping scores of, you know, what nations were in our camp, what was in the Soviet camp, and as I recall it, and how important was it in nation building efforts?
Yeah, I think it was overridingly important, and that's actually my argument, is that that's where these programs led awry, because the standards of promotion, you know, democratic police standards of promoting civil liberties, trying to abolish torture, just promoting a greater professionalism, that eroded to a certain degree because the political element became overriding, and the focus of the U.S. Programs were ultimately to train police to counter, you know, communist subversion, as they called it. So they ended up mobilizing the police more for political operations, and that led to, you know, clandestine surveillance and police raids and abuses against suspected communists. And in the case of Japan, I mean, the Communist Party generally followed a legal approach and had been a legal party. A lot of its members had been imprisoned for opposing the militarism during World War II. And they were, you know, they had members of parliament, so they began to face surveillance and harassment, and some were thrown in prison and treated poorly in the prisons. So it was a kind of exaggerated, fear of communism in many cases.
My guest today is Jeremy Kuzmarov, the Walker Assistant Professor of History at the University of Tulsa, and his new book is titled Modernizing Repression, Police Training and Nation Building in the American Century. And it follows up on his previous book, which was The Myth of the Addicted Army, Vietnam and the Modern War on Drugs, which is out a couple of years ago. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, let's talk a little about the current nation-building efforts, Iraq to a lesser extent, but Afghanistan today. When you compare these two countries to past nation-building efforts, one big difference I see is most of the insurgencies that were involved in these countries were nationalistic insurgencies. Perhaps a difference of political opinion, but basically they were insurgencies because they felt like the government was either too close to the United States or the United States was actually in the government. Today, it seems like it's far more, it's sectarian in the case of Iraq, it's ethnic in the terms of Afghanistan, certainly not nationalistic because in Afghanistan, you know, the ethnic differences, it's always been a very loosely conceived of government. It's ethnicity has been far more important than the Afghan national identity, I think.
I agree, although I think there is an element of nationalism in both of the insurgencies that has been recognized in
just
internal documents.
Outsiders in the country, you know, against the outsiders being in the country.
Yeah, exactly. And that has been a mobilizing force. But at the same time, I do agree with you. There have been tremendous divisions within those movements. And that's perhaps for one reason that the wars are drawn out and there's really no sense that the Taliban will ultimately take power, because I think there's so many divisions within the country, as you point out, ethnic and sectarian divisions. And that's, played into the police operations. Take Afghanistan. I think one of the problems there is that the U.S. has become unwittingly enmeshed in sectarian and ethnic or tribal conflicts in local areas. And they're trying to train a national police force, but these divisions have become manifest. And they unwittingly, at times, train sectarian militias that fight for sectarian reasons or commit abuses against villagers of a different ethnicity. And some personnel I've interviewed who are in Afghanistan have said that, one of the problems associated with some of these efforts is that they bring outside, I mean, the country is so fragmented and diverse, and they'll bring police, from a complete different area to police a certain province. And so the public sees them as outsiders, and they don't trust the police.
Mm. And I would assume that, the tensions between some of these ethnic groups are so on a knife edge. You hear all these stories of newly commissioned police officers basically opening fire on their U.S. trainers or on other police in their area. Mm-hmm. I think the tendency is to think of this as all Taliban, but it's probably as much sectarian differences and possibly, from everything I know about Afghan society, it's still a real sort of old-fashioned society as far as honor and mm-hmm. things like that. Is this having some sort of impact on sort of these incidents, do you think?
I agree, yeah. At the same time, it may be that the U.S. and the West has kind of overstayed their welcome in the country, and there's boiling resentment against their presence, and a lot of the police may simply join just to get a gun. And I think the U.S. soldiers feel they can't trust their own ally, somewhat like Vietnam. I think that situation enveloped there as well. And so you have often distrust among supposed allies. And they're also deep, as you mentioned, I mean, Afghan society, it's a very traditional society. It's very alien from American society. And American soldiers are placed in a very difficult situation there because they have trouble relating to the people. It's a huge cultural shock when they're over there. So I think you have, and this is something you do see historically, that you know, especially when U.S. personnel, that's actually perhaps one different with European police operations and their, you know, colonial endeavors, because the U.S. programs were also very similar to what Europeans were doing to stabilize their own colonial occupations. The Europeans tended to cultivate specialists in a certain country and would send these military advisors often for a long time, you know, to live in a country for years. And that was somewhat beneficial, you know, to them, because they could really develop a better understanding.
Knew the ins and outs of the culture.
Yeah, and develop a better rapport ultimately with their, you know, protégés and allies. Whereas in the U.S. tends to shuffle personnel in and out, and they never really develop a strong attachment or affinity or knowledge or deep knowledge of the society. So I think that affects relations in all facets of nation building, be it development or you know, intergovernment relations, and there's just a divide there that's hard to breach. And now that the occupation has gone on for so many years and there's resentment towards the Karzai government and increasingly towards the U.S. and West, I think some of those incidents are a product of that. And you have Taliban or others who are against the occupation simply joining up to gain a weapon and then turning that weapon against their trainers.
Let's talk about what happens down the road in these two countries. Iraq, we've pretty much turned over operations to the Iraqis. After a period of calm, we're starting to see quite a bit more sectarian violence there without the U.S. Seems like we're seeing an uptick in attacks against American personnel and NATO personnel in Afghanistan, despite all this nation building. How do you think these things are going to turn out?
Well, historians are very poor at making predictions of the future, so I can't predict. But, I mean, one danger of the police programs historically is that they build, if they're successful, there's a catch-22, because like Philippines, you know, Philippines, ultimately, it can be argued that the police operations can help to undermine democratic development in the country with a legacy to the present, because it developed this very powerful and formidable police force that ultimately was so powerful that it could shape political developments and warp democracy. And we see that in a lot of other cases where the U.S. built up very powerful apparatus, like Nicaragua would be another classic case. You know, and then the leader of the organization, in that case Somoza, himself seized power. And you know, the guard was loyal to him, and it was such a powerful force, it was a very easy step for him to emerge as the head of state and to rule in a very autocratic way.
So that's, you had like Marcos in the Philippines and yeah. Somoza. Yeah.
So that's one potential danger in both Iraq and Afghanistan, is, you know, political autocracy. If the country does stabilize, what we see right now in Afghanistan is probably the opposite, is that the police forces are so weak and the army is so weak, and you just have such strong, as you pointed out, internal divisions, that we may see continued fragmentation and civil war, whether the U.S. stays longer or not. Is irrelevant, that these tensions, and yeah, many have argued that one of the adverse consequences of the invasion of Iraq was the kind of intensification of sectarian divisions within the country. So, and that's a legacy of a lot of, if you look at British and French colonial interventions, sadly, there's an enduring legacy of, you know, because those powers often elevated one ethnic group to another to use them as a kind of client or to rule through them. These divisions often continued after independence. So that's a sad possibility for both Afghanistan and Iraq, that these divisions will continue to intensify regardless of U.S. policy.
Jeremy Kuzmarov, thanks very much for your time.
Oh, thank you.
Jeremy Kuzmarov is the J.P. Walker Assistant Professor of History at the University of Tulsa and the author of Modernizing Repression, Police Training and Nation Building in the American Century. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.